Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
Matt Gerandese is my name.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing McGee's sequel to his own film, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Fullest throttle.
Throttle harder. No, we're going to be discussing The Babysitter Killer Queen, which is not a brand new release from Netflix, but sometime in the last couple of months. In any case, for those of you unfamiliar with The Babysitter, the original film, the basic premise is that this kid who is probably too old to have a babysitter, he's like late middle school, early teens, discovers that his babysitter is the leader of a blood cult that is going to bleed him in order to conduct a ritual, and then all the members of the cult, if the ritual is successful, get to have whatever lives they want. Whether they want to be a famous reporter, one of them wants that, the other one wants to be a musician, etc., etc.
Yeah, and they're all different flavors of selfish, vapid
high school stereotypes.
Right.
So, at the end of the original film, and we get the shortest archive footage snippet recap right at the beginning of this movie, all of them are dead, all the members of the cult, and Cole, is the name of the kid, is having a sort of tender, sad moment with his babysitter, because even though she just tried to murder him, obviously there's residual fondness, as it turns out, on both sides. So, you know, it kind of ends on this upper downer note. So anyway, Babysitter Killer Queen follows Cole having gotten 2 years older and 2 years more ostracized. Basically, he can't get anybody to believe what happened to him.
Right.
His parents, anybody at school, even his friend Melanie, who it's alluded, witnessed at least some of the goings on. Matt and I watched the original movie together, but it was several years ago, and I don't remember all the details.
No, my memory is fuzzy. Could be a retcon, could just be a forgettable tertiary character who I have forgotten.
Sure. In any case, so Cole is grappling with all of this while also going through standard high school is hard things.
Yeah, the title drop is punctuated by him being hit with not one, but two dodgeballs in succession, not both at once. It would have been funny if they had impacted either side of his head. There's a freeze frame. The movie's full of kind of gratuitous freeze frames and fourth wall breaking gags.
Other stylistic flourishes. Yeah.
Sub Edgar Wright variety.
Anyway, that's more or less the short version. And now Matt's going to get us started on the long version.
We open with the aforementioned archival footage, and then we quickly jump into the present day. Got a little bit of VO, kid saying high school is harder than killing a bunch of Satanists. I don't remember the exact line, but that's the idea, is that his suffering knows no bounds. He is getting picked on, maybe because he's wearing a corduroy suit to school.
A corduroy three-piece suit with a patch on the coat pocket.
Yes, and there is a shot of him reclining on a psychiatrist's couch. It's a brown leather couch, and so it looks like he's just a neurotic head just floating in a brown abyss, just jabbering away.
Or he's got like a chameleon suit.
You're right. Either way.
Blending in.
This whole opening is like if Michael Bay directed Rushmore. It's like Wes Anderson by way of Michael Bay. It's really, really genuinely odd. His psychiatrist, therapist, nurse, jack of all trades joke character is this cut up whose name escapes me.
Big Carl.
Pulling triple duty as a therapist, a nurse, and guidance counselor.
Yeah.
And who knows what else. And he tells him, you just got to get laid, man. And that's, he's more right than he knows.
So Cole has hanging over his head the fact that his parents basically want to ship him off to the loony school.
Mm-hmm, the funny farm.
A quote-unquote psychiatric high school, which is not a thing.
I would have wound up in one if there was such a thing. But I know I'm not alone in that respect.
Right.
It's a trying time.
But yeah, he accidentally finds out that his parents are going to pick him up from school midday and take him to this facility that is a school and simultaneously a psychiatric institution to get him treated, because they've tried talking him out of what they think is crazy talk. They've tried getting him to take pills, and he sticks to his guns, rightly, as viewers of the original film know, as his parents obviously don't. Cole has found this out, and he tells his friend slash crush, as is so often the case with these things, Melanie, that this is going to happen. This is what I have hanging over my head. And she says, well, you should come out to the lake with me and my boyfriend.
And the whole squad.
And the squad. He eventually decides, yeah, fuck it. Better than going into lockdown, I guess.
Right, yeah. Being shipped off to Xavier's School for Gifted Youths. When is New Mutants coming out, by the way?
Well, it already came out.
Oh, did it? Yeah, oh, that's right.
It came out in August. It was a theatrical release because contractually it was required to be a theatrical release.
Right, yes.
They couldn't just boot it to Disney+.
It just came and went. I do remember. I was going to say that there was a missed opportunity here for some cross-promotion magic. Most ambitious crossover in movie history. So he's getting chummier with Melanie, his unrequited crush. A new girl arrives on the scene in the form of Phoebe, who establishes a lot of weirdo credentials right off the bat. She's being introduced to the class and, I guess, reads the temperature of the room and deduces, oh, I have to be really fucking weird in order to stand out here, because there's just a guy eating pudding at his desk.
I think it was yogurt, but yes.
And then another guy who's just like getting gains with some kind of exercise doohickey of some like arm training machine.
Well, I think that's Melanie's boyfriend.
It is, yes. The guy with the earrings.
Yeah.
Jimmy,
I believe is his name.
So she sizes up the competition and says like, okay, time to bring my A game. And then proceeds to rattle off a lot of nonsense. Oh, sorry, I'm late. Teacher says, oh, you're right on time. Oh, no, I'm 9 weeks late.
I think days.
Touche.
Nevertheless.
Should have been weeks. And then she just shrieks. She's like the misfit girl from Breakfast Club. At least that's how she's made out to be initially.
Yeah.
Just weird for the sake of it.
But also a badass. Ally Sheedy in Breakfast Club is just, like, weird kind of neurotic, but this girl is supposed to be a hard ass in addition to being incredibly strange.
Well, everyone in a Mick G movie is cool, you know?
Yeah, cool matter. In a way. Everyone is a different variety of cool. Like if you had taken Cole and plopped him down in a, you know, speaking of Wes Anderson, if you had plopped him down in a Wes Anderson movie, it's just like, oh, this is how people dress.
Yeah, right. You slap some Simon and Garfunkel under him instead of the dad rock tunes that mostly suffuse this movie.
Yeah.
You'd be right at home. So Cole and Melanie abscond in this ridiculous looking car, which I'm sure is in Mick G's garage.
let me just I just want to imagine him renting it out to the production for a fee.
Not a scratch on it, or so help me God. It's got this flame decal going all the way up the hood. It's just a big muscle car. I don't know. I know fuck all about automobiles, but it looks like a life-size Hot Wheels toy.
Yes.
Put it that way. Everybody piles in. They hit the road. There are a couple pit stops along the way of no consequence. They make it to the beach, and it's a big fucking, like, Bonnaroo beach party. And Cole very pointedly is sort of fingering the pill bottle in his pocket, and then he takes it out and tosses it into the ocean.
At which point I remarked, hey, dude, this is a place you could have sold those.
Right. But everyone's here to party.
Clearly he wasn't thinking ahead.
Yeah, not very enterprising of him. That night, they are all playing 2 Minutes in Heaven, I guess, because their generation is ADD adult.
Has 2/7 the attention span. Fucking zoomers.
Which is twice as much of an attention span as Mick G was born with.
These are
the
facts.
Script probably called for 7 minutes in Heaven. He was like, ugh!
He's like, fuck that.
I'm getting gray hairs just reading this.
Mr. Mick, what do we call you? You know, Mick G. we don't have to have the entire 7 minutes in the movie. Fuck it. It's 2 minutes.
I condensed my own name to 3 letters. Life's too short.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah, don't mind if I do. So Cole and Melanie get stuck in the closet for 120 glorious seconds and make out a little, emerge from the closet, and this is where the movie begins in earnest.
Yeah. So it's at this point that Boom Boom...
You can't just drop that name on our listeners.
Like, oh, I can, and I have.
Okay. I kept thinking of the baby from Flintstones.
That's appropriate. Yeah. Same name.
It's a Bam Bam, I think. Not to be a Flintstones pedant.
Yeah, but... you're right. My bad. I haven't watched Flintstones in too long. In any case, Boom Boom is one of the members of the squad that has come in the fucking obnoxious dadmobile.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, Melanie just fucking cuts her throat open with a big meat hook,
yeah.
I guess. And oh, shit, it's happening again. We've got a new blood cult headed up by Cole's bestie slash unrequited crush slash soon-to-be murderer, Melanie.
And as Cole is scrambling away on all fours, the old squad from the previous movie start coming in through the doors and windows.
All of whom we saw die in the original film.
Yes, and had we not, McGee is happy to regale us one more time with nanosecond-long flashbacks.
Or two or three more times, I feel like, some of the time.
Yeah.
The cheerleader, Allison Bella Thorne, had her head exploded with a shotgun in the first movie. She's back, not a scratch, etc. I mean, everybody died in gruesome, gushy ways in the first movie, and they're all just fine, and it turns out it's thanks to the devil.
So, as they're closing in on Cole, Phoebe, the weird girl,
shows up on her jet ski.
We later come to learn that she came to this beach party alone. We've seen her once before. I thought that she hitchhiked because she gets all out of a
she,
like an
18-wheeler. She hitchhiked with a trucker.
And then rented a jet ski, I guess.
Or there
someone.
Was just a jet ski there that she stole. Who knows?
Yeah, who can say? She's a mystery girl. Anyway, her jet ski is running low on fuel. She's knocking on doors, asking to borrow a cup of sugar, basically, seems
well,
like.
Sugar is bad for gas tanks, man.
Again, I know fuck all about automobiles, landbound or water. She sees the corpse on the floor with its throat torn out, says, right, peace, and then jumps back on the jet ski.
I believe the line is, you guys earned some serious cosplay.
Heavy cosplay, yeah. Cole makes a break for it, jumps onto the back of her jet ski, conveniently located at the bottom of a water slide, which is just some, I was reminded of like Adam West's Batman getting to the Batcave, you know, it's just like a really cartoonish. I imagine that McGee's own home is kind of set up similarly. It's like the only way to get to the front door. So through a slip and slide. So he lands on the back of her jet ski, says, gun it. They take off, are almost harpooned by one of the members of the cult, and they make it to the shore.
As it turns out, though, the harpoon has punctured the gas tank of the jet ski, and this becomes relevant because Melanie, sometime shortly thereafter, takes a lighter and throws it on the fuel trail, and that lights a path all the way to the jet ski, and it explodes. This is after they've already landed on some shoreline and scrambled up the hill a bit, so Phoebe and Cole are not just dead. The movie would have been pretty short otherwise. Not to mention, that's not what the cult wants, because they need to bleed Cole dry in order to conduct the ritual. But
yeah, extra rare, not charred to a crisp. Phoebe and Cole split up, much to his chagrin. She kind of just wants nothing to do with his nonsense, understandably, I think. And then she runs afoul of this sinister... So earlier in the movie, it's when she's introducing herself to the class, again, establishing her weirdo credentials. She says her favorite movies, it's a photo finish between Deliverance and any Rob Reiner film.
To which I think justifiably so said, what?
And wouldn't you know it, she bumps into this guy with a banjo playing what sounds like ding 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 ding. I mean, all banjo music kind of sounds a little bit the same, but I'm pretty sure he's playing the lick from
Dueling
Deliverance.
Banjos,
and
yeah.
I just got to say, one banjo does not a dueling banjos make. You kind of are missing your fellow interlocutor, I would say.
It's a solo duel.
Boy.
It's a Yule.
Solo Duel is going to be the name of my autobiography. He is a massive creep from the get-go, even if he wasn't polishing up his Deliverance theme when she happened to cross paths with him. He's like, oh, my wife went to go get more firewood. Why don't you come closer, warm up them bones, and so on. So she hunkers down beside him, and he reveals that his wife left 10 years ago. You know, oh, when's she coming back? I don't know. She left me 10 years ago. And then he proceeds to do what we knew he was going to do, which is make a pass at her, try to force himself on her. Cole shows up and, like,
delivers a monologue on s'mores.
Yeah, which is just a smokescreen. He's just buying them time. He just kind of makes an ass of himself. And then Bugs Bunny style, like, pulls his cap down over his eyes. And then they start running. And did he also tie his shoelaces together?
No, you're splicing that in from the classroom embarrassment scene from earlier.
That's quite possible. I remember the guy tripping as soon as he stands up, though. So there was some kind of hanky-panky going on there. Anyway, they have bigger fish to fry. One of the cultists shows up with a flamethrower, one of the ones from the previous movie, tries to torch them, succeeds in torching the would-be rapist. They steal his car, I think.
Yes.
Run her over. She survives. They run her over a second time, pin and her to a rock edifice.
I think it's actually the third time.
Third time,
but yes.
You're right.
And
one
then
for
she
every letter
gets...
in McGee's name.
She gets decapitated by a surfboard that flies off of the creeper's car roof.
You want to talk about contractual stipulations? I'm sure that he mandated that she be run over no fewer than three times. He bought himself 5 whole minutes from that closet scene, so he can afford to run over her all day long. Yeah, she's decapitated.
And true to McG horror form, gouts and gouts of blood from the neck stump.
Yes.
Unfortunately, when Cole is trying to back away from this and drive away, he does it without looking, trying to be cool, and immediately gets stuck on a boulder. So they have to hide underneath the car, wrestle a snake.
Yes.
While Melanie and Jimmy and Diego is the other member of the new squad. They all show up. There's a lot of fuckery, but it ends with the good guys getting away and the bad guys having to chase them some more.
They are running over cliff tops, and they are set upon by the cheerleader from the first movie whose name escapes me.
Allison.
And she tries to pursue them into a crevice and gets her head stuck. And it was not clear to me if they were trying to free her or if they were trying to do what they end up doing.
I
what
think
they end up doing.
It was an intentional execution.
What they end up doing is ripping her head from her shoulders by using their own bodies as like a counterweight, just kind of dangling from her until most of her comes unstuck.
Yes. And then falls to the ground, and then a boulder drops from the sky.
McGee in fine form as per usual.
Yes.
Then the shirtless guy from the last movie
Max,
comes after
I
them,
think.
Chases them down onto a dock. They're trying to steal this guy's speedboat, and they can't figure out the passcode. Boat is named Jenny, by the way.
3 guesses as to what the 7-digit code is, and the first 2 don't count.
Well, like Max, my brain also went to Forrest Gump first. I, you know, I'm a 90s baby, because he starts going, like, oh, name's Jenny. That's my boat. Because he kills the boat's rightful owner and then is chasing them down the dock. But then he drops the second reference in under a minute, which is...
Tommy Two Tone.
Yeah. Sing it with me, folks. 8675309. And then they plug that into the little passcode screen and they're off and running.
John, the other tracksuited member of the original cult, has showed up by this time. And he just sort of spectates while Max, Mr. Shirtless, jumps onto a tube that is tied to the back of the boat with a rapidly unspooling rope. All right, go get them. And this takes us into the next set piece, which is them trying to shake him loose from the back of the boat, and he just keeps pulling up the rope closer and closer. After some back and forth, they light him on fire with some silly string, which I guess is flammable. I'll take their word for it. And then they manage to get the rope caught in the propeller, which then gets him dragged through the propeller and chopped to pieces.
Yes, sliced and diced. The whole cult, such as it is now, they're dropping
rapidly
like flies.
Dwindling.
The whole cult, more or less, is standing on the end of the dock, and they are all pretty disenchanted with the project at this point. Several of them want out.
Jimmy and Diego both try to bounce, and they apparently have broken the contract with Satan because they immediately explode. Unlike many McG explosions, it is not a gushy one. It is a flame and smoke explosion.
Yeah, it's fire and brimstone.
Yes. So now we're down to two goddamn cultists.
Yeah, in the blink of an eye. We've got
just John and Melanie.
Yeah, Melanie and John, correct. And Melanie concocts a plan to call in reinforcements of a kind, which is to say she gets in touch with Cole's fretting parents and says, can you come pick us up? You know, playing the doe-eyed sort of babe in the woods.
Yeah.
Like, he's really freaking me out. He went off his meds.
Yeah, Cole's dad has been hanging out with Melanie's dad. Because I guess Melanie's dad is either a weed dealer or he just has lots of weed all the time. And they smoke up together a lot. And
the movie has been cutting back to them periodically. Much is made of the fact that Melanie's dad has the newest Halo game. But every time we see him playing anything, he's got an Atari 2600 joystick in his hand.
Yep.
Those games are easy to wrap your head around. You know, if you're really baked, I imagine that there would be some appeal there.
Right. But they're seen playing VR games at one point.
That's true.
But in any case, the two dads pile into a car and are driving out to help. Meanwhile, Phoebe and Cole have reached the cabin that Phoebe has been trying to take them to. Apparently, it's her family's cabin. Her family, as we've found out by this point, died tragically. And she later confesses that, quote-unquote, she killed them. Really, she left her doll somewhere, and then they had to go get it, and there was a car accident. Now she blames herself. But anyway, they're trying to get to this cabin to hunker down for the night because the cultists have to achieve the ritual before daybreak. Otherwise, they, in the case of the old cultists, they get sent back to hell. In the case of Melanie, it's not immediately clear, but presumably the same thing or something similar. Meanwhile, Melanie and John are taking like a little metal boat with a little outboard motor on it, and John's at the tiller, and Melanie's like halfway between George Washington and Captain Morgan.
Yeah,
just perched at the prow of the boat, leg thrust forward. It's almost like she's got her hand above her eyes scouting ahead.
Right.
And they're chasing him down, and of course they get there, and the two dads get there. But before this, Cole and Phoebe get down into, she calls it her rabbit hole. There's a trap door, and it's just this kind of like root cellar ass room. It's got a bunch of her old toys in it.
They at this point have, in the course of, you know, falling into one another's arms, told each other about their childhood dreams, and hers was apparently to be Alice from Alice in Wonderland, go on all kinds of topsy-turvy adventures.
Yeah. After a near miss that I really thought was going to be his only shot, Cole gets another chance and they start fooling around, and eventually, we don't see it and we cut away, but they have sex, which is an important plot point for later.
Yes.
So everybody's in the same place now. Everybody left standing at present. Melanie and John are there with the two dads. They're trying to coax Cole out of his hole. Eventually, Cole and Phoebe come out armed to the teeth because apparently her dad also kept his hunting gear down there for plot device reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they come up. There's a bit of a standoff. John ends up getting killed by an antler chandelier that falls on him. And
seems Cole, like, he consistently is on the wrong end of stabbings. Like, I did not remember any of the deaths really individually from the first movie, but McG was kind enough to refresh my memory. And the first movie, he gets something through the neck.
Well, yeah, that's like the finisher, because he like falls off of a banister or something, hits his head a couple different times, and probably breaks his neck. But yeah, then, yeah, for good measure, his neck gets like nearly completely severed by one of those.
Was it like a bowling trophy or something?
It's some one of those like glass awards, uh-huh. like diamond shaped things.
So true to form, this time he also gets impaled. That's a little grislier than it's not as clean. The first two deaths in this movie are both decapitations, which I thought was a little been there, done that. But he is consistently just kind of eviscerated in ways that some of his compatriots aren't.
Yeah. Phoebe and Cole get out and they split up.
Much is made of the fact that he's delighted to still be alive when they're on the dock and the two cultists just exploded in front of him because he's a black guy. And he's like, I'm not supposed to still be alive. And he's, you know, riffing on this meta joke.
Some post-Jordan Peele, you know, et cetera, uh-huh. et cetera.
Yeah, it's like, well, that you fumbled that ball a little bit if you're reserving the most grisly death for him at the end of the day. But,
yeah, well, you know. In any case, Cole's dad chases him down and tranks him, basically. Meanwhile, Melanie chops up her own father back in the cabin
mm-hmm.
and then gives chase. She ends up catching Phoebe and tying her up at Cult Ritual Cove. I mean, there's a bunch of Wicker Man ass fucking
folk horror scarecrows.
Yeah.
Arrayed around the beach.
So she's got Phoebe tied up to one of them. Meanwhile, Cole's dad is driving him away, but they have to stop at a gas station, except it's not exactly a gas station because the point is made that it's an electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. So he's got his plug pump thing going. He manages to set off his own car alarm because he's still kind of stoned, which wakes up his son. Apparently, Cole's dad has also like locked the car and left the keys inside. Again, he's stoned. It's fine.
Yeah, so Cole commandeers the vehicle after a kind of mushy heart-to-heart with his dad about persevering through adversity or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he takes off into the night to go to his lady love's rescue.
Yes. So he gets there and he basically just plops down in the wicker throne. He's like, okay, let's do it. Let her go. You got me. Emerging from all the folk horror scarecrows are all the members of the original squad reconstituted. And then we're waiting for one more. And this mm-hmm. is when we get B.
Yes, the titular babysitter killer queen.
Yes. She fucking emerges from the water like Godzilla. Just ascends. And yeah, you know, they bleed him dry, mix his blood with Boom Boom's blood, because apparently that's the procedure. You know, you got the sacrifice and you got the innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And mix it together in this chalice. And they start drinking. But we notice that B is kind of side-eyeing this, like, I don't know. And as it turns out, because Cole and Phoebe got down, he is no longer an innocent. So the blood is tainted, the ritual is tainted, and they all get wrecked. And it turns out that this was B's plan the whole time.
Yeah. Imbibing the blood of a Chad is apparently like opening the Ark of the Covenant. They're all just incinerated. And B pointedly does not drink.
Yes. We discover that B used to be Phoebe's babysitter, which presents some wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey time fuckery, because when B was Phoebe's babysitter, Phoebe was like six.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Cole, as we established at the top, was early teens, but I don't know, presumably
she's been regurgitated by hell on
a couple
more
times,
more than one occasion. Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, they just sort of hand wave that away.
Woken up from her kaiju hibernation on the ocean floor.
Anyway, it was B who was driving one car that Phoebe was in, which crashed into the other car that her two parents were in, carrying the doll. That whole "I killed my parents" thing we were talking about. And basically, B made a deal with the devil to save Phoebe's life. I guess Phoebe was in critical condition at the hospital. So, you were my guardian angel all along. Cole is all sunshine and rainbows. He's like, great, we can all leave now. And B's like, unless I'm toast, you guys are fucked. And so she drinks from the chalice after greeting Cole's dad, who has, I guess, walked all the way here. I don't know how he got there, but he's there, and he's obviously surprised to see her. And as he's making his way down, she drinks the blood and then goes up in fire and brimstone, which Cole's dad happens to see, and so now he believes him. That's more or less it. We get a little coda where Cole, now risky businessing his way through a session with the therapist slash nurse slash guidance counselor, wearing the sunglasses, guy's collar popped, being a little badass. And yeah, that's the movie.
Yeah, so, all I had to do was get laid.
So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some thoughts on Babysitter Killer Queen after this.
Let's go, Cole!
Oh, you okay? You look like you've seen a gorgeous black ghost.
Don't worry, guys. I'm good.
Where's Sonya?
Getting cookies.
I watched you all die!
We are dead. Duh.
Clearly, you guys are into some heavy cosplay. Just leave it be.
Ow!
Oh, yes! Oh, shit!
Oh, no!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Update me on the Psycho Breakfast Club.
Basically, they're a blood cult, and they made a deal with the devil.
And they only have 3 hours to complete the ritual.
We could hide out till sunrise.
We finish this, we have to go back down to Limbo.
I love you, Cole.
Finally found my dick, Cole!
Could this night get any more erotic?
And we're back. So, I guess what I want to touch on right up front is that The Babysitter, the original film, was fine. It was a... I rated it on IMDb a 5 out of 10. And that is...
There you go.
That is...
I might have gone as far as a 6.
A 5.5. It's a rock-solid 5.5 out of 10. And a big part of that, at least for me, and I'm inclined to believe that Matt will agree, is that Samara Weaving, who plays Bea, is a very charismatic actress, very enjoyable screen presence, and she contributes a lot to that movie. And indeed to any movie she headlines. We did an episode on Ready or Not some time ago now, and she was the lead in that, and she was very good in that. She was a big part of the reason why that movie's good. And so, yeah, that's a lot of what made the original Babysitter decent. Without her, it would have been bad. And so, Babysitter Killer Queen does have Samara Weaving in it, but only for like 15 minutes at the end, and also... for a grand total of like 43 seconds of flashback appearances scattered throughout McGee's no attention span mind palace shit.
Well, and even when she makes her belated debut into this movie, she's been largely sapped of her personality. I mean, she shows up in this sort of deus ex machina capacity where she saves the day and has none of the mischievous quality that she had in the first movie. Or, I mean, on a nuts and bolts plot level, there is still the whose side is she on question, but then that question gets definitively resolved almost immediately, and she heroically sacrifices herself, which was really not what she was about in the first movie. This is going to be another case. This comes up every time we review a sequel. I said in Gallows Act 2, on the basis of some of those criticisms, you would think that I was had like a real hard-on for the Gallows Act 1, which I didn't. Because I just kept saying, like, oh, this strays so much from the source. And the source was no good. But you still want to see a franchise kind of be true to itself. Or if it's going to do a course correction, to do it in, I don't know, a well-considered way. Here... I mean, I like the first Babysitter a good deal more than I like the first Gallows, but her characterization in Killer Queen did give me Gallows Act 2 vibes, where...
aggressive retcon vibes.
Yeah, well, it's just... and it's retconning her on a character level. I mean, she's just not the same person, it seemed to me. It's like her most recent stint in the underworld mellowed her out.
Right.
Which I have a hard time buying.
Like, I'm going to reference a different sequel that fit into this paradigm. Like Brahms the Boy 2.
Yes.
Babysitter Killer Queen takes something that was, if not the most interesting thing, among the most interesting things in the original, and retcons it into being worse. In Brahms the Boy 2, there's this whole, the doll was never haunted at all. There's a disfigured man living inside the walls. Well, that's the original. And then in Brahms the Boy 2, yeah, no, the doll was actually haunted this whole time.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a case of trying to have your cake and eat it too. And I feel like this movie pulls a similar trick in that, in the first movie, and I believe it was marketed as such too. I remember you being a little put off by the fact that she wound up being one of the cultists, because mm-hmm. the first movie was billed as babysitter and her charge
versus
murderers.
Cultists. Yeah.
And then it turns out she's in on it. And that's not like a late game reveal. It's right from the jump, basically. But there's always this notion, you know, maybe she might be cajoled into, you know, because she is fond of the kid and he's totally over the moon about her, which is what gives the first movie a little bit of pathos, you know, because who in going through puberty did not foster an inappropriate crush on someone like 3 or 4 years your senior?
Right. And they basically try and pull that trick a second time in this movie with Melanie. Obviously, there isn't that age gap thing, but it's at the same time, it's this girl that he's had this unrequited crush on for so long.
Yeah.
Turns out to be the one who's going to try and murder him.
Yeah, he's suckered into exactly the same ambush by another...
And they're, you know, they're both gorgeous blondes.
Yeah, by another beguiling blonde, exactly. It's like she's Bee's mini-me. And it's just, which is just a thankless role. I mean, the actress playing Melanie does her best with it, and she is enjoyable, but it's I don't know why they hewed so closely. It just makes, when Bee does show up again, the babysitter proper, she is, they've created unnecessary redundancies there, I think.
Yeah.
And I also think that there's another redundancy in, you know, they introduce this new clique, Boom Boom and Melanie and the rest of
them.
Well,
they're in a hurry to get rid of it, obviously.
Right. And then, yeah, and then all the gang's all here. The, you know, the original crew comes in through the doors and windows. And then Melanie's boyfriend and Max, the shirtless guy, they, like, you don't need both of them. They're the same joke.
They are both Chad.
Yeah, it's just if one of them has a shirt and one of them doesn't. And that's the extent of the differentiation. So they just ran out of, I guess, high school archetypes to riff on, but I don't know. Try harder.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of differentiation in that Max is the dude bro cool guy and Jimmy is the completely meat-headed jock with zero brains. So they're like slightly different, but it's still
the
same.
Six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Right.
As far
I mean,
as
it's the same fundamental archetype, even mm-hmm. if there's a little bit of variation there. Just very finely separated subtypes.
Yeah, I still say that it mostly comes down to wardrobe or lack thereof. So I wasn't crazy about the new squad of Satanists. I really am not as enamored of the old squad as I think the movie expects me to be. There should be this like, oh, it's Max. Oh my God. It's
Allison.
I can't even commit to this bit because I've already forgotten all of their names.
John.
Right, it's like, it's not like the fucking, it's not like the Beatles got back together, you know, dial it back. This is,
yeah,
the babysitter is fine. It's a 5.5 out of 10 if you take our consensus view on it. So what the babysitter had going for it that Killer Queen doesn't is the pathos that I alluded to before. The through line, dramatic through line of that movie, to the extent that it has one, is Cole is crushing big time on his babysitter who is out to kill him. And it's not a tearjerker, you know,
no.
But it'll make you feel a faint flicker of something.
Right.
This movie made me feel just nothing at all, except for a steadily mounting sense of ire to do with some of the redundancies that I've talked about and some weird characterization choices. I went off about Bee's character changing in between movies already. I also was put off by the way that Phoebe was handled. She's introduced in Breakfast Club fashion, like I said,
right,
with this litany of bizarre quirks. And we get, you know, that she's just poking out her porcupine quills, you know, that it's all for show.
Sure.
That she's trying to keep people at arm's length. But there's not even a vestige of that weirdness at any point later in the movie. And I was struck by this when she shows up on the jet ski, you're still thinking like, huh, what an oddball. But then basically once they make it to the shore, the jet ski explodes. Then she's shoehorned into this damsel role with the mountain man by the campfire tinkering with his banjo. And she's just so guileless in that scene. He says, oh yeah, my wife went out for firewood. and then she just buys it. She sits down. She's shivering. Oh, so when do you think she'll be back? There's just no street smarts. She's not savvy at all of a sudden. And Cole has to show up and rescue her. And just, I thought, okay, that was a weird flub. But then throughout the remainder of the movie, she's just a normie. I mean, she's just, even down to like, so when they're in the speedboat, talking about their childhood dreams, he says, so what was yours? And what did you want to be when you grew up? And she says, I can't tell you. It's too weird. And I thought internally, I guarantee it isn't.
It's really, it couldn't possibly be.
I promise you, it's extremely basic. And then she says, I wanted to be Alice from Alice in Wonderland. Cue this exhausting, 4 or 5 minutes of screen time where they make it to her family's cabin and they go down into the basement, which she calls her rabbit hole, and she's got a tea set out, and they start playing the goddamn Jefferson Airplane song,
which
feed your head.
Matt and I,
yes,
some years ago, this is an aside, but I think it's appropriate. Some years ago, we went to see the film Killing Them Softly with Brad Pitt, the Andrew Dominik film.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, that movie's fine, maybe even kind of good. But there is a scene in the movie where there's a couple of derelicts doing heroin. Mm-hmm. And
wouldn't you know it, the song on the jukebox is Heroin by the Velvet Underground.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, I remember, and you know, I've gotten so much of this shit wrong on this show. I was wrong several episodes ago about the guy who fires Norman Osborn loudly slurping his coffee. And that mistake will haunt me till my dying day. I think I might have even been wrong about the Phil Collins thing when we talked about Risky Business.
So I
take this with a grain of salt and then some. But I am pretty sure that this scene opens with it like slowly irising out from black. I just seem to remember it's hazy. I mean, it's filmed through like a gauze of some kind or some kind of post filter thing to indicate that they're
whacked out.
That their veins are full of junk. But yeah, they're just sitting on a couch, and as it dawned on me, because I heard, you know, the strains of this song that I recognized, and then came to gradually this dawning, oh no, as it became apparent to me that the scene was in fact going to be about heroin use, about junkies, and you know, it's just the other scene that gets stuck in my craw, and this is kind of the like textbook example for me. I talked about Forrest Gump earlier. The montage of Forrest Gump running from coast to coast is set to
Running
on Empty by Jackson Brown. And then Against the Wind, Bob Seger, which is, I'm still running against the wind.
Yeah.
And then it keeps you running. It's just like one after another. And it's like, in heaven.
It's like the aggressively dumber version of American Werewolf in London. All the songs have the word moon in the title.
Right, but that was cheeky.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
And although it deprived us of having Werewolves of London in that movie, which makes me sad all the time. just every day. I just wake up thinking about it.
Yeah, you in your corduroy suit on the psychiatrist's couch. Doc, I can't help it. I'm just never not sad.
Just, ooh, Werewolves of London.
Draw blood. Where the fuck was I going? Right, there's a bunch of that in this movie. The Queen song, Killer Queen, also plays when the cultists all get their comeuppance. And
Bee's just sort of smugly looking at all of them.
Yes, watching them die because she's a killer who has killed them.
Anyway, the reason I brought up the Killing Them Softly thing, not just to illustrate this phenomenon and how this is not the only movie that does this, I also bring it up because...
Yep.
When we got the White Rabbit cue, I stopped the movie and I looked at Matt like, So is this better or worse than
killing them softly?
He just cut me off. Like, yeah, I thought I was gonna have to lay that out. Nope.
No need.
Nope, we were on the same page.
Certain movies do just, and yeah, and Killing Them Softly is, I haven't seen it since it came out. It got on my nerves. It was set up to fail because I think Assassination of Jesse James is kind of a masterpiece. So Killing Them Softly just isn't up to snuff for me. However, that movie is basically fine. That scene, however, some scenes do just become emblematic of certain tropes or certain pitfalls, and you file them away in your brain as reference points. And that scene, the heroin scene, is one for me. And so, I mean, yeah, we've alluded to it many times over the years, and that only calcifies it. You know, once right. you start trotting it out and using it as a shorthand, then it's never going away.
No. We've talked a little bit about McGee's various stylistic tics. I think that's the appropriate, because they don't even feel so much.
Seem to be able to control them.
Yeah, and they don't seem to be choices. They don't seem to have any particular motivation behind them. It's just, let me do this weird thing that does not fit in with the flow of the movie, but, you know, look at me, I'm directing a music video or some shit.
I think the most egregious one for me was when he gives two characters health bars on screen during a fight.
Yes.
And with a big Street Fighter 2 font, like, fight at the beginning. It does everything except have one of them administer a fatality to the other, which I know is a Mortal Kombat thing.
Right. Well, it's
one of them throws a fucking Hadouken, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
Like a Dragon Ball Z move, you know, partway through the scene.
Yes. Yes. Phoebe does to Melanie. Melanie ends up getting the drop on her, which is how she gets captured and nearly Wicker Manned. The other one is, what the hell is the song that's playing on the tape player?
Oh, it's that fucking, Tonto, jump on it, yeah. Jump on it.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the name of it.
I don't know.
That song.
That's a song I only remember when I'm listening to it.
Right. Or just going into a fugue state about a high school dance or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it occupies the same void space in my brain as, like, the cha-cha slide.
Yeah, it's
or Mambo number 5.
Right, it's one of those. Only
fucking Macarena.
Only we know the titles of those songs, and this one we don't.
Right.
And we're too lazy to look it up. Anyway, Cole starts playing that on this boombox in the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they start making out a little bit, we cut to the two of them doing this dance on a light-up disco dance floor.
Uh-huh.
With everybody else in the movie, basically, like, all the cultists are hanging out and
goofing around,
you know, yeah, goofing off and dancing around and stuff.
And it's intercut with stock footage of, and this is a gag that I remember seeing on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air a long time ago, obviously, when Carlton is deflowered. There's a montage set to Ode to Joy of, like, a bee pollinating a flower and then a dog catching a frisbee. And then a train going into a tunnel, like North by Northwest style. And I remember that being pretty funny when I was like 10 or 11, when I watched that rerun. And this movie does the same trick. There's a shot of a guy, like a human cannonball, getting shot out of a cannon.
There is literally a shot of a train going
into a Wilhelm stream.
Yeah, yeah. And there is literally a shot of a train going into a tunnel. A hot dog going through one of those, like, all-around bagel dog type buns.
Yeah, and given that, like, avalanche of, you know, kind of
phallic imagery,
I'm just amazed that no one makes a joke about rabbit holes, you know? I mean,
right.
that seems,
yeah, that's,
like,
that's kind of a, yeah.
It almost makes me think that it didn't occur to them, which is impossible. Like, it's impossible that they exercised self-restraint, but it's also impossible that that joke did not present itself to them if they were juvenile.
You know what? I want to imagine that somebody brought that up in the writer's room, and then McGee was just stone-faced, and he said, What does that mean? What are you talking about?
You're fired.
That's nonsense. I still have to give you credit, but I never want to see your face again.
This is one moment of clarity. That, or he insisted that it be in the movie, he was outvoted, and then said, fine, but now I'm definitely going to run over the flamethrower chick 3 times. And there's nothing you can do to stop me.
And this is when he went from 4 minutes in heaven to 2 minutes in heaven.
Yeah, there's just, I'm not sure. I mean, they are ticks. They are basically unmotivated. I do think that there's a little bit of I don't want to say that it's canny on his part. I do think that it's a little bit more mannered than that would imply. I do think that he's trying to ape a particular style. And what kind of cemented this for me was a scene near the beginning when Melanie is telling Cole, oh, you don't have to be ashamed of being on pills. Everybody's on something. And then she points out several people in the hallway, and it's like a pharmacological zombie land. It's like how one of those fucking movies in Zombieland, it's the rules, you know, they'll come up on the screen. It's you've seen this gag 100 times.
It's like you're in an MMO and you've just walked into a marketplace.
Yeah,
and everybody's trying to sell you something.
Yeah, all of a sudden the hallway turns into like Ready Player One, and you can see, or like fucking, it's like in Watch Dogs or whatever, how you can pull up one random factoid about everyone you bump into on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what substances everyone is using and what disorder they're trying to medicate out of existence. The movie's full of stuff like that, and it just doesn't feel like a coherent style. It feels like bits, and I feel the same way about Ruben Fleischer, speaking of Zombieland. I complained about this a little bit in our Double Tap review, because he's like favors these kind of ostentatious long takes, but watching them, I'm never reminded of like Iñárritu or Scorsese. I'm reminded
or McQueen even.
Yeah, I'm reminded of Hunger. It just feels very video gamey.
Right.
And then here, when McGee does it, it also feels like sub-cinematic to me for some reason, which might be why it is referenced Watch Dogs, a series I've never even played.
Right.
It just, there's something about it that feels unearned, and I don't know, it's like watching someone hammer nails with a spoon. It's like, you'll eventually get the job done. It's just not the right tool for the job. And who he's aping specifically, I think, is Edgar Wright more often than not.
Well, yeah, what I was about to say was Ruben Fleischer is like a sub-Edgar Wright knockoff. And McGee, at least in the context of this movie, is like a sub-Ruben Fleischer knockoff of a knockoff.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, it does feel derivative, which is a problem when a movie is trying to impress its wackiness upon you. Derivative wackiness is poison. Secondhand zaniness is just the kiss of death.
It's the difference between wackiness and wackety schmackety do.
Yes.
A Patton Oswalt-ism that we have invoked on this podcast at least a dozen times, mm-hmm. and will likely continue to do so as the need arises.
The dialogue in this movie is highly, highly totes magotes. I don't think anyone actually ever says totes magotes, but at any moment, anyone could say totes magotes.
Yep.
In response to just damn near anything. And this is, usually you get one character in a movie who talks like this. I'm thinking, for whatever reason, of, it's not actually Danny McBride, is it? Who's the dad in the Halloween, it's not a reboot, the David Gordon Green Halloween, who goes, oh, I got peanut butter on my penis. Do you remember that guy?
Vaguely.
Okay, anyway, that line seems like it was trying to be a meme, you know, and it's still lodged in my brain, for better or for worse. Anyway, yeah. There's usually like a character in modern day horror comedies who has that kind of glib, wacky, zany, would-be trendy sort of jive. But when everyone talks like that, it's like how everyone's cool in a McGee movie. You know, if everyone's cool, nobody's cool. If everyone talks like this, it's just noise. And it's just on and on and on, to the point where no character is too unimportant to get a little half-assed comedy sketch devoted to them when they show up. The cop who comes to the home the cop who comes to the home of Cole's parents is a real prankster and says a whole bunch of bullshit, but he ends his closer is that, well, you know, most runaways come back after 24 hours. If he's not home tomorrow, then I'll call ICE, baby. And then he like touches the mom's chin. He like swats the mom's chin with his wallet or his badge or something. It's just cringy. I'm trying to think of a context where ICE could be invoked that I would find funny, but it's not that one. And you know what? I'm not fucking triggered by it. I'm just calling a spade a spade. There is like a latent, I think. So this would-be millennial jargon is usually deployed this way. As I was going back and forth on this, I was thinking like, who is this movie for? It started feeling a little bit The Hunt to me at various points, and it's more low-key than that. Almost anything would be.
Yeah.
But there's a line, Melanie near the end says, the future is female.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, this is, you know, I think that this kind of imitation millennial catchphrases, these are usually deployed in like a straw man mocking kind of way. And it didn't really put me off. I just have a hard time. And I had the same reaction to The Hunt. I'm just having a hard time imagining anyone being tickled by this. And it was, and I don't think it's not like hateful. I think bringing The Hunt into it makes my case sound a little bit overblown.
Right.
But it seems like there's a latent,
it's just like, in the same ballpark as
there's
that.
Just a latent conservatism underpinning it, I think. Well, even the moral of the movie is all you have to do is get laid. And I'm on board with that. I mean, but I heartily endorse that message for confused young people. But even still, so the first movie had that boy-babysitter relationship pathos going for it. This movie is a much more conventional kind of coming-of-age thing for him, almost in like a...
It's like anything. I mean, I don't know if you're trying to think of a particular dude has to get laid in high school movie, but there's just... There are thousands of them.
Yes.
So,
and
yeah.
So for me, that goes hand-in-hand with the sort of millennial bashing sneaky conservatism that I was picking up on elsewhere. You know,
right.
It just seems like a very traditional package for a movie that is sort of branding itself as subversive or unpredictable when it's anything but. And it's obviously 80s nostalgia bait too. It's pandering, so it was never gonna reinvent the wheel, and I wasn't expecting that. But for a filmmaker who throws this much shit at the screen to see what sticks, there's not that many curveballs in there.
No.
Thematically, ideologically, or stylistically. Basically, like Phoebe, the movie is not as weird as it thinks it is.
It is even less weird than Phoebe is.
Right. I do like, and it given how harsh this review came out, it kind of sounds like more of a threat, although I was still kind of amused by it. Oh, what's the name of the guy who gets antler chandeliered?
John.
John says if they fail the ritual again, they're going to have to spend another 2 years in limbo before Satan will give them another chance, which I thought was kind of amusing because it's sort of an oblique reference to the sequel industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like if this movie flops, who knows if there'll be a third one, which okay, that's kind of, given the way the rest of the meta gags in this movie are pitched, that one was actually kind of subtle by McG standards. And I thought that was funny.
Also, I think the first movie sat on a shelf for a couple years before Netflix released it.
Ah, there you go.
Because I think I just happened to catch trivia for this movie, and it said something like, well, the reason why Cole looks so much older is because the first one was shot in 2015, and this one was shot late in 2019.
I thought, like, puberty hit that kid like a speeding train.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
That makes more sense. Phoebe's normalcy really is bone deep. It even her trauma is boring. Like the thing, I killed my parents. As soon as I heard her say that, I thought, okay, I've heard this song before.
Car accident. Yeah,
it was
okay,
my fault.
Yep.
Because I needed them to go get my toy or whatever. It's the same shit from Polaroid, right?
I mean, basically, she was getting taken to a sleepover,
right,
or something. Yeah.
But yeah, right. But she needed something from her parents. They were driving her somewhere. There was a car accident that would not have happened if she hadn't insisted on her parents taking her to a place to do a thing. And I just feel like, I mean, the bar is not set at Polaroid. I've seen worse movies than Polaroid, but you really don't want to inherit any DNA from Polaroid. If Polaroid did it, it's been done better, and you should try to think outside the box a little bit more. I think Polaroid is almost a perfect case study in what not to do. I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of anything that Polaroid does that is really worth doing at this point.
Matt finds children getting their parents killed in car accidents almost as tedious as he finds wives killing themselves in the bath.
In the bathtub, yes. Yeah, dead parents behind the wheel, dead wives in the bath. Good God, you know, just like, I don't think people don't even realize they're doing it. I think it is just autopilot kicking in, and it's deadening. It's just so very deadening. The one moment in this movie, I said before, you know, the cop shows up and starts riffing. Every character, no matter how small, gets a chance to be a cut-up and a class clown. The one time that there was a whiff of improv about something that really killed me was when, you said John, right?
John, yeah.
Was when John starts, like, MC Hammer dancing back and forth to run interference on Cole when he's trying to escape the cult. He starts, like, he looks like he's about to break into the rah-rah Rasputin like Cossack dance. It's really funny and could not have been in the script. I mean, I just did not get that impression from it at all. And no. So that was inspired.
Yeah, no, that was very
funnier
good.
On the screen, obviously. Okay, so I've done my due diligence. This movie has things to recommend it, but on the whole, it is worse than The Babysitter, which is to say it is
less than a five.
Numerically,
and a half.
Yeah, lower than a 5.5.
Well, I guess at this point we can jump into our recommendations. What I want to start with is a movie that Matt and I watched relatively recently, and it's called We Summon the Darkness.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
It's another cult movie, basically. It's another horror comedy involving
a killer queen.
A killer queen and a sacrifice, and it follows this group of dudes who are, well, the dudes come in later. But basically, there's this group of three women, Alexandra Daddario, and then two women I don't know, and then this group of three dudes, one of whom was in Escape Room. This is the most I know about these people. But in any case, the women and the dudes, they all meet up at this, like, hair metal concert.
It's like a Whitesnake concert or something.
Whitesnake or Scorpions or whatever. The women invite the dudes to go party at one of their parents' houses. And it turns out that they drug the dudes and are going to sacrifice them. And actually, they're not devil worshippers.
No,
they're,
quite the opposite.
They're extreme evangelical Christians who are staging all of these Satanist ritual murders to drive people into the arms of their church, basically. And this is a movie that is trying to do at least some of the same things that Babysitter Killer Queen is trying to do, and I mean Babysitter also, and I think it does them better. There's none of the sort of pointless stylistic flourishes. There's no wackety schmackety do. There is character-based humor, which is the good kind, and I don't know, it's better.
It is better. I wasn't blown away by it, although in light of the movie du jour, I think it does, yeah, my esteem for it has grown somewhat.
Right.
It does have Johnny Knoxville playing a televangelist,
which is
kind of fun, although they don't let him cut loose with it the way I might have liked. No, We Summon the Darkness is a pretty good time. I like that it's a period piece. I mean, it's set in the 80s, and so it is actually about the satanic panic.
Right.
In a way that feels a little bit incisive, more so than anything in either of the Babysitter movies, really. I mean, it's got just a teensy tiny bit of thematic heft to it, thematic substance to it. I still think it falls prey to some of the same totes magotes tier dialogue issues that I brought up earlier in this episode, but no, it's not as out of control as it is in this movie.
This movie, it's rampant. There, it'll pop up, and then they bring it back. They rein it in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not omnipresent.
Yeah.
So I'm relieved that you didn't steal an Edgar Wright movie out from under me, because I think I am just going to recommend. I mean, Shaun of the Dead is my favorite by leaps and bounds. So I'm just going to say, if you haven't seen Shaun of the Dead, go see Shaun of the Dead. I'm not totally nuts about Edgar Wright, but I think that Shaun of the Dead is like a 10 out of 10. I love that movie, and I hate zombie movies, and I hate zombie comedies in particular. To the point where I was very late to the Zombieland party. I only watched it in anticipation of us reviewing Double Tap. And I liked Zombieland just fine. But when that's like one of the top five zombie comedies, then that's a subgenre I could just do without.
Right, you know? Right.
I mean, if that's like a bronze medalist in a given genre, then I don't want to see anything worse than Zombieland, I guess is what I'm saying. And that includes Zombieland Double Tap, as the case turns out.
Right.
So Shaun of the Dead is, like, peerless, at least once you shrink the category down to zombie apocalypse comedies. I mean, it's got some of that encroaching dread that you get from an actual George Romero movie, which most zombie movies don't have anymore, even the ones that aren't trying to make you laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Dylan Moran is really funny in it. Obviously, yeah. You've got Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. They're bound to be there. But the whole crew is just a blast. Bill Nighy is excellent. It's the one Edgar Wright movie where the zippy, snappy editing never grated on me even a little bit. Mm-hmm. Or like felt, you know, because I like Hot Fuzz. I like World's End. More than a little, actually. Those are both very fine films. But they're I always feel a little bit of fatigue setting in every Edgar Wright movie except Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead is just exhilarating for me start to finish, and I don't know why. I would have to watch several of his movies in succession in order to like do an intensive autopsy of like what makes this movie tick, or just what makes it work for me like gangbusters the way that it does. So you have almost certainly seen Shaun of the Dead, but I think it's really great. And just on a stylistic level, well, almost any Edgar Wright movie is going to run circles around Mick G. I haven't actually even seen Scott Pilgrim versus the World, although I surely would have brought it up, especially by the point that Mick G was literally plastering health bars on the screen.
<You know>? Yes.
I mean, talk about being late to the party.
Yeah, 10 fucking years late.
Right. So check out an Edgar Wright movie. Shaun of the Dead is my fave. That's it, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to go the spoilers for Hot Fuzz, if you want to go for the murderous cult route, Hot Fuzz.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
If you want to be thematically related.
True that. True that.
Well, I guess that's it for The Babysitter Killer Queen. I'm Jim Smith.
I just thought of something.
Okay.
There's a good bit of banter in this movie devoted to Terminator 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remembered as we were sitting here. So basically, this is how it plays out. Cole brings up at one point his love of T2, Judgment Day, and then this comes up when he's talking to Phoebe, trying to explain what he's up against to her. It's kind of a shoehorned reference. They keep talking about the T-1000 with its liquid metal alloy skin and all this.
Mimetic alloy.
Yeah, mimetic. Thank you. My child of the 90s brain failed me just then. She says Terminator 2 is one of the few sequels that rises above its predecessor.
She puts a specific figure on it,
which is just, come on, don't play games with my heart like that. I'm that kind of movie dweeb. If you say, oh, top four, you know, oh, why not three, why not five? Someone her opinions sound very definite. I'm not saying the whole movie should have been paused just so that I can sleep at night, just so she can
like, okay, off. Godfather 2 and then what?
Yeah, you know? Empire and go on. Point being, I forgot until we started recording that Mick G directed the fourth Terminator movie.
Oh my god, I did not remember.
I think it's really, it would have been very on brand for him to be like, yeah, it's one of the four sequels that triumph over its predecessors, Godfather 2, Empire Strikes Back, Terminator 2, and Terminator Salvation. Obviously. And then Cole goes, I know. It's so underrated. And then, you know, the big credits roll over them just gushing about Terminator Salvation. Anyway, that's all we got for you today. I'm Matt Gerandese.
I'm Jim Smith. And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Babysitter Killer Queen official trailer Netflix, uploaded by Netflix. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 29th, and we'll be discussing another Netflix original, His House, a haunted house film examined through the lens of the refugee and immigrant experience. See you then.